Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Jerry Sandusky will have his day in court. The former Penn State defensive coordinator will face a jury. And abuse victims, if they choose to testify, will face him. This is a case that will wind its way through the legal system toward a verdict we cannot presume, but towards some form of justice.
In other words, the process of holding individuals to account is already underway in Penn State around the sex abuse scandal. But what about institutional accountability in general?
That is one of the questions that resonates deeply here in Boston, where, of course, more than a decade ago, the scandal of sexual abuse by Catholic clergy was brought to light. What at first looked like criminal actions of individual priests soon expanded into widespread and intense criticism of the Vatican itself. And to this day, some abuse victims demand the institution of the church be held to account.
So today we're going to talk about Penn State and Boston, about powerful men, cultures of silence, and institutions that look the other way.
And you can join the conversation. How do you think the Penn State scandal has expanded the conversation about child sexual abuse here in Boston? And for Boston Catholics, when you heard the story about Penn State, how did it hit you? And for everyone in general, when individuals go to trial, what do we do about institutions? What, if anything, can and should be done to change the culture in any organization, sports, religious, official, that has stood by as children were abused? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Well, joining us now in the studio is Mitchell Garabedian. He is the Boston attorney who has represented more than 1,000 victims of sexual abuse by clergy in the greater Boston area. Mr. Garabedian, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us today in the studio is NPR sports correspondent Mike Pesca. He's filling in this week for Tom Ashbrook at On Points. We're delighted to have him here in Boston. Mike, welcome back to you.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Mike, actually, I want to just start with you because there seems to be a little bit of news every single day about what's been going on in Penn State. Can you just bring us up to speed on the latest there?
Well, some of the latest developments, it has recently been revealed that Joe Paterno, the longtime coach of Penn State, months ago, and in advance of the investigation or the results of the grand jury, transferred ownership of his house to his wife for a dollar. You as a lawyer, Mitchell, would know better if that, well, maybe you don't know Pennsylvania law, but apparently the official Paterno and Paterno lawyer explanation is this is just estate planning. Apparently, some legal experts say this could protect the home in case of some sort of legal verdict based on what happens in this case. Now, maybe we have to go back and talk about what was Joe Paterno's involvement. He was not charged with a crime. As you indicated, Jerry Sandusky, Joe Paterno's former assistant, was the one who was allegedly committing all these child rapes. But there were two other individuals at Penn State who were charged with crime. That was the administrator who was essentially in charge of the police there, and also Tim Curley, who was the athletic director. Mm-hmm. And by letter of the law, Joe Paterno, although we know that he is in reality sort of the emperor of State College, Pennsylvania, the most powerful man in State College, Pennsylvania, by the letter of the law, he's really just seen as a middle manager. And so all he had to do was report to his bosses that someone reported this to him, and therefore he's off the hook legally. So the theory goes at this point.
Is there any more news or any other findings about sort of the reverberation on who else at Penn State or at the Second Mile, the organization that Jerry Sandusky had founded that worked with At Youth Risk, things that have happened there? I mean, yeah. I read some reporting that said there are files from the Second Mile for a period of several years that have just gone missing.
Yeah, and no one knows why that is. The president of the Second Mile was not charged, and it's never seriously been alleged that he knew about this, but he did resign. Now we're seeing all these celebrities who, some of them even said, I didn't know I was on the board of the Second Mile. Apparently, a lot of these guys just say yes to anyone who seems to be working for a good cause. And so celebrities are now saying, we want nothing to do with the Second Mile. I don't think it's going out on a limb to say that charitable organization is done.
Mitchell Garabedian, you have represented more than 1,000 victims of sexual abuse by clergy here in the Boston Boston area. When you first found out about what was happening at Penn State, what was your reaction? And I hear that your phone's been ringing much more than usual recently. Why?
Well, my reaction is that it was another cover-up. Here we go again. The pedophile was molesting innocent children, vulnerable children, and they were keeping the matter quiet because of fear and other reasons. Supervisors like Joe Paterno were keeping the matter quiet. He didn't go to the police. And the institution, like the Catholic Church, was keeping the matter quiet, silent, secret. Secrecy feeds these pedophiles. It allows sexual abuse to happen, and we have more secrecy at Penn State. And you're going to find that there'll be more than 100 victims coming forward over the next 30, 40, 50 years.
You say more than 100,
based on the fact that they've already got a handful over the course of 15 years. Based on my experience with the Catholic Church, pedophiles are serial pedophiles. They're not people who molest one child. They are serial in nature. They molest children until they have stopped, whether it be by death, by dying, or whether it be by the law. Until they stop, they molest children. Father Gagin, for instance, was in a retirement home in his late 60s, and he was still molesting children.
And Mitchell Garabedian, I've been hearing, and I heard you on NPR, saying that people who had previously not talked about abuse that they say they've suffered at the hands of clergy have started calling you once again in the face of hearing what's happening at Penn State.
Yes, I usually get 10 to 15 calls over the course of 2 weeks, and I've got that has doubled. What has happened is you see individuals who've been sexually molested feeling empowered and encouraged. They don't feel as isolated. They feel as though they will be believed if they come forward. And that's the pattern you see with victims of sexual abuse.
Well, I don't know if it'll be 100. I mean, I read the report that came out, the analysis of what happened in Boston, and there are a small number of pedophiles who actually, you know, molest one person. And there is a number of pedophiles who molest, you know, however many people, but it's not necessarily in the hundreds. So we don't know what the number will be with Jerry Sandusky. I defer to your expertise.
I disagree with you. Pedophile, by the very nature of the act, children are forced into secrecy because of fear, and they do not reveal it. Yesterday, a man 87 years old called me. And he said he was sexually molested. He came forward for the very first time. Earlier this year, a man 86 years old called me and said, I've been carrying this around for 80 years.
Okay. Well, let's talk
I think I misunderstood. I thought you were saying that it's going to be shown that Sandusky has molested hundreds.
It will be shown.
Well,
let's
talk a little bit about, I mean, Mitchell Garabedian, you mentioned this, and obviously this is the reason why we want to discuss this, about the institution that's surrounding these two particular cases. I mean, Mike, You called or you said that the former head coach of Penn State was also known as the Emperor of College Park,
yeah.
Pennsylvania. Tell us a little bit more about the importance of the football program and the sports program at Penn State and why Paterno carried so much power there.
At a Division I school, at a Big Ten school, which is a powerful conference in Division I, whoever holds that position institutionally is going to be powerful. Joe Paterno was so much more powerful than that. To give you a perspective about longevity, Joe Paterno was at Penn State longer than Queen Elizabeth was Queen of England, longer than Fidel Castro was president of Cuba. He was head coach of Penn State longer than any pope has been a pope, longer than any Supreme Court justice has been a Supreme Court justice. When he came into Penn State, 52 of the 54 countries in Africa were not even countries. He has been there such a long time. He has won more than anyone. Most of the students at Penn State, so many of them had fathers, many of them had grandfathers who went to Penn State. He became a symbol of the school. He became to symbolize why they were going there. When they protested his removal, the vibe that I got was that they ripped from them almost a family member. He was known as Joe Pa, short for Joe Paterno. Reminded me of Grandpa. This was striking at something that was so fundamental to their identity, they didn't even know how to process it. That's how I explain a lot
does
of the rioting we saw.
Does that also mean that there's the possibility that since he had been there so long and since the football program that he had built at Penn State became unassailable? I mean, that his decisions became unassailable because, you know, he was, quote-unquote, Joe Pa.
And that is true, but you also have to realize that the very time that we know that he was told about the child rape in the shower in 2002, and there was evidence, by the way, that he knew about some of what Sandusky was doing even before them, that was a bit of a perilous time for Joe Paterno because he was in his mid-70s, and coaches don't coach that long. Now he's 84. This is totally unprecedented. But he was in his mid-70s. Penn State had just come off two losing seasons, and so we don't know if he said, I am going to cover this up, or in his mind he said, this is the last thing we can afford now. I'll do the bare minimum.
Dial
and just 911. Kick it upstairs.
Dial 911. It's that simple.
Mitchell Garabedian, I'm asking Mike Pesca to sort of help take us inside the structure of the institution of Penn State to help us understand how we arrive in situations that are like this, where decisions are made or not made that end up allowing, as you said, alleged abuse to continue to persist. I mean, these are strikingly similar situations as we've seen with the Catholic Church.
It's very simple. They're more interested in their wallet than the safety of children. They're protecting their image. They don't want their image tarnished because it's going to cost them money. So they let children be sexually molested. All Joe Paterno had to do was call 911. It's a moral decision. It isn't a legal decision. It's a moral decision. Oh, someone was raping a child in the shower. Maybe I should call the police. No kidding, Joe Paterno. If the NCAA had any guts, they'd take Pennsylvania football, Penn State football off the calendar for the next year.
Although, as Mike Pesca does point out, as far as we know, Joe Paterno did follow what he was legally obliged to do. But Mike, let me ask you.
But not morally.
But Mitchell Garabedian raises this point that Charlie Pierce, who's of course an NPR contributor, also wrote about in the online website Grantland about, and I don't know if I'm touching a third rail here, about the money and the importance of things like college football for a college like Penn State, for a university like Penn State. I mean, bringing in millions of dollars, a huge source of branding for the university, that the fear that anything that could tarnish that might be, and again, we don't know what was actually going on in the minds of people there who are in leadership positions, but that is a very weighty consideration for a university with a powerful sports program.
I would suggest, and I have no idea what was going there either, but all of this was operating on this subconscious level, or maybe subconscious isn't even the word for it, but it's just in the climate. It's not as if conscious decisions. It is quite possible that conscious decisions weren't being made, that Joe Paterno knew and understood the importance of what he was being told and said, I must cover this up to keep the funding going. And yeah, there's a lot of money at stake. It could just be, as an 84-year-old man, he didn't quite understand, or he didn't want to understand. He didn't want to face what his old friend and colleague and a guy who was so important to building his program, Jerry Sandusky, was doing. It's quite possible psychologically, you know, victims are an abstraction when you first hear about them. Jerry Sandusky's a real person. And you weigh it all in a split second or in a non-really well thought out way. And all that could be is, what do I have to do? All I have to do is kick it upstairs.
Mitchell Garabedian, hang on for just a second, because I just want to be clear that we're not trying Jerry Sandusky here on this show.
This is ridiculous. I mean,
but we're also
what I just heard, absolutely ridiculous. All he had to do was dial 911. It's a moral decision. It's an institution that educates children. It's supposed to set an example. And what kind of example did it set?
Do you
it
hear
let
me?
Innocent child be raped.
Mitchell, do you hear me saying that he shouldn't have done that?
No, I'm saying is he should have done that.
Yes. No.
Okay?
I'm going to step in here. And
what he didn't do was call dial 911.
Let me reiterate that we're not trying Jerry Sandusky. We're not trying Joe Paterno here at this table. What I'm trying to do is have a discussion about what leads to events like this persisting. What is it about institutions, whether they be colleges or sports or a huge global institution like the Vatican, where when there's evidence of some sort of abuse, people choose or don't choose things to do that lead to the persistence of that abuse. And I just want to let our callers into this conversation because I've got a lot to say. You know, we are talking about Penn State and obviously how it resonates here in Boston. And Mitchell Garabedian, I promise I'll give you a chance to say stuff, but we've got some callers who I think you'll be interested to hear from. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Air Risen is calling from Winthrop. You're on the air.
Hi, Magna. This is Arisen.
Oh, hi, Arisen. Sorry, I said your name wrong. Thanks for calling.
No, that's okay. To answer your question exactly, I think what these have in common is this is a good old boy code. And I don't mean to be a feminist about it, but what I see here is men protecting men. And no matter what, you can't break the man code. And I, if this were just about money, that would be different. But I don't think that's what this is about. I think this is definitely about, you know, you got to be strong, you got to be a man, and no, you can't turn your friend in, and, you know, and it's at the sacrifice of children.
Thank you so much for your call. Let's take another call from Lowell. Jim is on the line. You're on the air, Jim.
Magna, thanks for taking my call. This is all very interesting because I grew up in a very small town, very close to Pennsylvania, very close to Penn State, and I mean, the whole school was held on, and the football team was held on such a pedestal that if you did not support Penn State, you kind of did so at your own risk. And I think when that happens for year upon year upon year, it just creates this situation that that it's like Joe Pa is St. Joe. And everything that goes along with that. And it, that people don't believe that anything like that can happen. Even when they see it happening, they can't believe that it could possibly actually be happening. I must not have understood what I saw. It must not be that. It could not. It could never be that in this institution.
Jim, thank you so much for your call. Mitchell Garibedian, your response to that. I mean, Jim's starting to get at sort of where I hope we get to go with this conversation, that what is it that makes people say this can't be happening?
Well, in response to both callers, there's a certain reverency, whether it's the Catholic Church or Penn State. It's ingrained in the person. You have to follow the rules of this institution, whether it be the Catholic Church and the priests there are Penn State and the football coach there. You have to be obliged to perform whatever they say you want. They want you to perform whatever it may be, whatever task it is. Turn your back on this innocent children. You have to do that, or you're not a true Penn State student, or you're not a good Catholic.
In places like Penn State and Central Pennsylvania, the phrase is around here, football's like religion. I think that's notable.
Yep. Mm.
Mike Pesca, let me ask you a little bit more about the issue of leadership, for example, in institutions where sports is so important. What is really the relationship between, you know, head coaches and the president of a university?
Yeah.
And how does that work in terms of practical decision making when it comes to internal accountability?
The president of the university should be the head football coach's boss. De facto, it often works the other way around. We recently saw Jim Tressel dismissed as the head coach of the Ohio State football team, and President of Ohio State, joked, and he got into trouble for it, but it was the sort of gaffe, which is defined as when you accidentally tell the truth. They asked the president, how long will you be president? And he said, as long as Jim Tressel will have me. So that's the backwards relationship here. Even though football's actually a money loser at a lot of these institutions, and at Penn State it's not, it just brings so much prestige to the university, except in a case like this when it brings, you know, horrible, horrible ignobility.
Mm. Mitchell Garibedian, I mean, do you see that sort of that same relationship between leaders and the people they're supposed to be leading within the church? And do you think it's the same today, that there's not enough internal questioning?
Oh, it's the code, as was stated by an earlier caller. There's a code, and the code is you protect the institution, whether it be Penn State, the Catholic Church, or the Boys Club, or the Boy Scouts, at any cost. You have to protect the institution, or you're not worthy of that institution, and they're going to kick you out.
And why do you think that law enforcement doesn't get involved more intensely and quickly in the times where it can and should, where the story has leaked out of the institution?
I agree with you. They should get involved more quickly.
What do you think is preventing that?
I think the culture has to change. I think the attitude has to change, and I think the laws have to change. For instance, in Massachusetts, we need statute of limitations done away with in many in sexual abuse cases. Criminally and civilly. There are no statute of limitations in murder cases on the criminal side, and there should be no statute of limitations on the criminal on sexual abuse side in criminal cases.
Let's take another call. Kim is calling from Revere. You're on the air, Kim.
Hi.
What's your thought today?
A friend of mine, it just reminds me of a case. We were training for the Olympics, and she had a coach that raped her from the ages of 13 to 17, where he started to lose interest in her. And it took a very long time before he was finally put in prison. But a lot of the, you know, when it became public and it was national news, a lot of people blamed her as much as they blamed him, because they had a close relationship with the coach. And, you know, I found it kind of astounding that so many people somehow blamed the 13-year-old for, you know, something that was obviously, you know, not her fault. And I think part of it might have just been the demonization of the idea of a pedophile. If your friend is a pedophile and you have loyalties to that friend, you can't imagine that there's something actually criminally wrong with that person. Because in your mind, a pedophile is, you know, somebody from CSI, not your buddy.
Mm. Were you guys swimmers? What was your sport? Could you say what your sport was?
I've heard of Dan Doyle and Kayla Harrison.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Kayla Harrison's a world champion in judo.
In so many instances, a person judging another person in a scenario like that looks at an adult, and they see the adult reporting the sexual abuse, and they don't see a child reporting the sexual abuse. And when they're shown a picture of the person who's 13 years old, their whole demeanor changes, like, oh, wait a minute, now I get it. Oh, I see what you're talking about. Because right now I see a 45-year-old person in front of me, and it's kind of like, why did you let it happen? But when you see that photograph of that 13-year-old, it changes. The demeanor changes.
I think that's one of the things about this Penn State case that maybe has shocked the nation and the world as much as it has, because in the grand jury report, there's testimony from people who said that they witnessed things happening to 10-year-olds, for example.
Yes.
And so they weren't coming forward as adults. It was, I mean, some of them did, but...
Yep.
Kim, thank you so much for your call. And Mike Pesca, I wanted to pick up a point that Kim was making about the complication in the coaching relationship.
Yeah, and that, Kim is talking about this relationship in the sport of judo. It just came out today that the top U.S. gymnastics coach was found to have engaged in improper relationships with the girls he was coaching. Swimming recently had a big scandal. This is not unique to Penn State. I think far from unique to Penn State. There are a couple unique elements. Frank Noonan, who is a former FBI guy who now runs the Pennsylvania Department of Police, said that in 30 years of doing his job, he literally never heard of an eyewitness to a rape. So not a rumor of a molestation or seeing something that didn't seem right. A literal eyewitness to a rape, which is what Mike McCreary, the a graduate assistant at the time, saw, that went nowhere. Like that, something that shocking usually does get reported to the police. And I think it very well could be because of all these things we're talking about how important it is to the institution. One other thing I just want to add, talking about the laws that we need, it was a law that actually tripped Sandusky up because he volunteered in the local high school. Mm. And local high school officials are required by law to report anything like this, unlike Joe Paterno was at Penn State. And as soon as the local high school coach saw him wrestling on the floor with a 12-year-old, he immediately reported it. And so those fine civil
And then
servants,
the school reported it to law enforcement.
And then there was no question that there was going to be a case here. It had to get out of what we're talking about, that institution, that football institution of Penn State.
Does beg the question, though, why is it that these laws are limited to places like schools, for example? But go ahead, Mitchell.
I've had many occasions where a parent has reported it to police in the past. They've taken their child to the police and reported it. And the day after the parent has gone to the police, for instance, the priest will go to the police department and say, that woman, you know, she's not quite all there, and she doesn't know what she's talking about. So within the culture of the institution, they have another layer of covering themselves if it's reported. And that's what they do quite often, and what they have done quite often in the Catholic Church.
And that, by the way, literally happened in this case in 1998. A mother of one of the sons, her son was in the second mile, and he showed up with his hair wet and said he was showering with Sandusky. And the police staged a meeting between Sandusky and the mother, but they didn't bring charges, and it's unknown why they didn't bring charges. And the DA at the time, actually, this is such an unbelievable wrinkle to the case, went missing. He's America's most celebrated or notorious missing person, so we can never ask why charges weren't brought in that case.
Let's take, we have a comment here from Kurt Koletka on Facebook, who writes, the fact that this scandal got people talking about child sexual abuse is progress enough. However, Kurt also thinks that the real story is about how so many people wanted to sweep this under the rug because of Joe Paterno and the Penn State football program. Kurt's a Penn State alum, and Paterno got a lot of passes just for being Joe Paterno, as you've mentioned, Mike. Mitchell Garabedian, let me ask you, let's try and push forward to seeing if there are any ways to suggest solutions that might bring about culture change. I mean, we've been dealing with this issue so long in the Boston area for, you know, over a decade, at least publicly. Have there been any ways, anything, maybe just even the conversation itself has helped change the culture here in the city or in the church?
Let me just say that victims are heroes. And part of that heroism is to come forward and report this. Report this to the police and speak out publicly. There's no need to feel that shame or embarrassment or guilt or lack of self-esteem that a victim feels. It's all unwarranted. The victims did nothing wrong, and they can change the culture by coming forward as they have been for decades now. And the culture is changing slowly, but it's because of the victims being heroes.
Let's take one more call. John is calling from Cambridge. You're on the air, John.
Hi, thanks for taking the call. As horrific as it was at Penn State, I think there's one huge difference between the way Penn State handled this and the way the Catholic Church has, and that is that Penn State Board of Trustees, in fact, fired the president, fired two senior officials, and to my knowledge, the Catholic Church has not held one bishop who transferred these pedophiles from church to church accountable for his actions.
That's a good point, except that it happened at Penn State after they got caught. They didn't show up voluntarily 10 years ago and say, hey, we have a problem within this institution, and we have to correct it. After they got caught, they act as though they care. And where were they 10 years ago? Where were they 15 years ago?
John, thank you so much for your call. Mike Pesca, do you think that this is going to serve as a wake-up call to other colleges and universities across the country, at least to sort of reassess what the relationships are between athletic and administrative leadership?
The answer is probably no. And calling around to different athletic directors or talking to journalists who have done so, here's how they think. When the University of Michigan gets busted for practicing too much, when the University of Miami gets busted for having boosters give money to students, and when Ohio State University gets busted for trading jerseys for tattoos, every other school across the country talks to their compliance office and says either, do we do this, or how can we stop this, or tell me, guys, we're doing it right. Those are things that affect a college football program. I would say that no one had a gut check on, is there pedophilia running rampant in our program? And everything we're saying today is that's not the point. The point is the culture of entitlement, and maybe some people are having that discussion, but I think
maybe
the people within that culture are more like, this isn't a problem that would happen here. I would even venture to bet that Penn State, if this happened at Boston College and Penn State were reviewing it, Penn State would say this wasn't a problem that could happen here. But I will say on the positive note that Barbara Bradley Haggerty did a report saying one thing that confirms what Mitchell is saying. More and more victims are coming out, and she also said because it's a sports scandal and people don't have to be news consumers, you could just be a sports acolyte, not expect it, it falls in your lap and you say, you know, this happened to me, and maybe you do come forward, so maybe there's some positive out of it.
Just a couple seconds to go, Mitchell Garabedian, last thought goes to you.
Victims should be proud of themselves. They should step forward and report the abuse. Don't be ashamed. You have nothing to be ashamed about. You are heroes.
Mitchell Garabedian is a Boston-based attorney who has represented more than 1,000 victims of clergy sexual abuse. Mitchell Garabedian, thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you for having me.
And Mike Pesca, NPR sports correspondent and filling in this week for Tom Ashbrook at On Point. Always great to have you, Mike. Thanks so much.
You are welcome.
Well, everyone, tell us what you think and keep that conversation going online at radioboston.org. Coming up next, our weekend picks. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty with Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.